Our next panel is really dealing with the issue of our time, one that, as you can tell, as you may have noticed, cuts through almost everything that we've discussed so far today. We know now, beyond a doubt, that Russia successfully intervened in our election and tried to shape our democratic process. And the key questions are, what are Russia's broader aims, and what can we do to protect ourselves? We have a superb panel to address these questions. Let me introduce them to you. Ned Price, you guys will just raise your hand and make sure people know who you are. Ned Price, former senior assistant to President Obama and a career CIA officer. Evelyn Farkas, former assistant secretary of defense for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia, with vast experience on Capitol Hill, the executive branch, and the academy. And Yulia Yaffe of The Atlantic, one of the country's most prolific and incisive authors on Russia. And our great moderator, Jim Sciutto of CNN, I'm sure very familiar to all of you. Jim reports and provides analysis at CNN on all of the network's platforms on all aspects of national security. So let me turn things over to Jim Sciutto.
Thank you. As much as it pains me to do this, I should also note that both Evelyn and Ned are contributors to NBC, MSNBC. Credit where credit is due. You'll notice that the previous iteration had Peter Clement from the CIA, and that is not Ned Price. A previous iteration had Sergei Kislyak. And I've asked Ned to play the role of Sergei Kislyak today, which he's agreed.
Do my best.
So
no one will remember anything.
All questions from the audience directed to Russia go to Ned. I mean, certainly a lot to talk about. One thing that strikes me just as since I've arrived 24 hours ago at this conference is hearing current administration officials asked how they rectify the official government and intelligence agencies' position on Russian interference in the election, rectify that with the president's public comments, if not to the contrary, often expressing doubts that his own most senior advisors do not have. And at times, you know, delivering something of a confusing message. I want to ask Julia, because you know Russia very well, how does Russia read that counterpoint, that dissonance between what the president says about it in public, and we don't know what he said in private to Putin, and then what the agencies and his senior advisors say about Russian interference?
Well, this is why they like Trump. They think that he brings a fresh view on Russia to Washington. And as one person close to the Russian foreign minister told me, right now Trump is Gulliver tied down by the Lilliputians. He's trying to establish better relations with the Russians, but the Washington establishment, the national security foreign policy establishments in Washington that hate Russia, in the Russians' view, I think that's pretty accurate, are not giving him room to maneuver. And he's expressing the line that they obviously agree with and trying as much as he can to get rid of the ropes tying him down, which is also why you see these, you know, impromptu meetings very secretly on the side of the G20, on the sidelines of the G20, allegedly the president's son-in-law attempting to open up a back channel with the Russians. I think the view is that you want to bypass and circumvent the national security establishment because they hate Russia anyway. They have a very fixed view on things, and it's keeping everything frozen in place.
Do they see that as an advantage?
What is it?
As an advantage that they have an American leader who doesn't take a hard line on the interference.
Absolutely, but right now I think they're very frustrated because they haven't really gotten that as much as they thought they would have gotten by this point with President Trump because, again, he's tied down by the Lilliputians.
Right. Evelyn, I know you said to me as we were preparing for this that it was your view that President had a year to deliver, in effect. Explain what you mean by that.
It's because, Jim, well, first of all, I should say thank you very much to our organizers, yes. Clark and Walter Isaacson, Jane Harmon, everyone who made this great conference possible. I would say the reason I say that is because Vladimir Putin is going to announce that he's going to run again for re-election as president of Russia next year, early next year. And that's why I figure he has about, Trump and Putin have about a year together to make some new cooperation. The reason for this is because when Putin first came to power, and I think everybody here knows the story of, you know, he made a deal with the Russian people that they would get borscht in their bowl, their economic situation would get better. That, of course, is no longer possible. Now he's on the nationalist, he's got the nationalist bargain with the Russian people, I'm going to make Russia great again, you're going to feel great about being Russian. And that means that he has to use nationalism in his campaign when he's running again. And the flip side of his nationalism is an anti-Western, anti-American, and anti-liberal democracy kind of rhetoric. And I don't see that sitting very well with our government and even with our president. So I think that the timeline, and even the Russians themselves, you've heard the Kremlin spokeswoman saying, or I think actually the foreign ministry spokeswoman saying, we're at the six-month mark. They're very much aware of the timetable. And that's why I said the year.
So as you, what would be in that category? What would be considered wins from, if, for instance, the removing of sanctions is too high a bar, what would Russia consider a win in terms of we're getting payoff?
Well, what the Russians want, I'll start with that globally. I mean, they would like freedom of action. They would like to go back to a 19th century sphere of influence, right, certainly in Eastern Europe and in Central Asia, the former Soviet space. But they also would like it in Syria and other places. So I think the first place where we see the maximum likelihood for some kind of deal between the United States and Russia that would be a cooperative deal would be in Syria. I don't know what that is, but we see signs, if indeed it's true, that now we've removed our funding from the CIA-backed forces in Syria, that certainly would be a concession to Russia, which would lead Russia to be even more stronger at the negotiating table, because ultimately this will all be solved, this being the Syrian civil war, will be solved at a table, at a negotiating table.
Can I just jump in here? The sanctions bar, I think, was not very high. You had Mike Flynn, the former national security advisor, very short-lived, promising essentially in December that the sanctions imposed by outgoing President Obama would be essentially the shortest-lived U.S. sanctions ever. And here we are 6 months later, nothing has happened. And you see the Russians are extremely, extremely frustrated by the expulsion of their diplomats / espionage people and the seizure of their compounds. And they're making extremely anti-American statements, calling Americans highway robbers, et cetera, threatening retaliation. Finally, it's kind of a delayed reaction, finally threatening retaliation for those last Obama sanctions.
You are listening to a live broadcast from the Aspen Security Forum with Active Measures, the Kremlin Plan to Beat the West Without Firing a Shot. This is Aspen Public Radio. It is our summer pledge drive, and we can only bring you live broadcasts like this with your financial support. Please call now 920-9000 or pledge online at aspenpublicradio.org.
But there's a countervailing case that maybe it wasn't. Obviously, President Trump faces a lot of political pressure in everything he does vis-a-vis Russia. Is now under a microscope, but I think in another way, this Putin has already endured possibly the greatest win he could have ever imagined. The fact that there is a panel here that we are talking about Vladimir Putin as a master strategist or master tactician, and obviously this is not a singular experience. This has been repeated over and over at Aspen and other prominent forums. What Vladimir Putin wanted just about as much as anything else, if not more, was to be on par with the United States. He was infuriated when President Obama called Russia a regional power. He wanted to be the superpower. He wanted to be what the Soviet Union was in its glory days. And in a way, he has put himself on par with President Trump, who spent nearly 4 hours with him at the G20.
I want to get to the sort of strategic win versus tactical win for him, because I know there's some debate about that. But before we get there, I remember I was sitting on the same stage this time last year with Director Clapper, 2.5 months before the IC officially named Russia, but he was all but naming Russia as being responsible. And he said at the time, and again before the IC had assessed that that they believe Russia actually intended not just to disrupt but to aid Trump over Clinton, he said that a lot of the driving force was just embarrass U.S. democracy, embarrass the U.S. political process. So if we're asking this question, did Russia win? Is this a victory for them? On that point, would you say, and I'll leave this to whoever wants to pipe in first, that in itself, I mean, just the back and forth and the questions and the doubting of the intelligence community and the fake news, et cetera, is it Can you say on that goal, at least, Putin already won?
I think that when we talk about Russia having a singular goal or a singular way of achieving that goal, we're mischaracterizing Russia. Mm-hmm. I think the Russians start with a maximalist position, and then, you know, if they get some of it, they're okay with that. Mm-hmm. I think there were many goals in what they did in 2016. One was to make us look foolish. One was to discredit democracy, in part because of their, for domestic reasons, and for the situation in the so-called near abroad, the former Soviet states, and in Eastern Europe, right? You had, after 1991, after the end of the Cold War, the global consensus was that liberal democracy is better and it works, and the Russian, the Soviet way of doing things doesn't work, and it's immoral and it's bad. And you had all these, you had Russians and you had former Soviet republics and Eastern European people striving to be, to change their societies into some modicum of this liberal democratic order. Now he's showing, look at the liberal democratic order. Yeah. It's not so hot, is it? And maybe our way of doing things is a bit better. Maybe you don't have as much freedom, but things are more stable. You don't have to worry so much about what comes tomorrow. So that's one motive. Then there's Hillary Clinton, that, you know, there's definitely no love lost there. Mm-hmm. I just don't think there's a singular motive and a singular like, this is what we're doing, A, B, C, D.
But I do think clearly we are fighting with one another. Our democracy does look weaker at the moment. And I think our president is treating, you know, Putin, again, as not even as an equal, almost as if Russia's a stronger country than the United States. It's baffling. I'm sure if you polled Americans, they would think that Russia's like the number two economy rather than number nine by GDP. So I think that's a win for them that maybe they didn't even foresee. The other thing is the language of relativism, you know, the "we also kill people" kind of line that Trump uses, that he's adopted a lot of this Kremlin tactics and the language that they use domestically in the United States. And that's very dangerous, because all you need to do is look at what's happened to truth in Russia and, you know, very much wish that that doesn't happen here.
Yeah, fake news and the very existence of facts. Inconvenient information is deemed questionable.
And early on, I have to say, it wasn't, Ned and I were talking about this the other day, it wasn't just to raise up Trump and hurt Hillary. It was also, for example, Russian media. I was in Russia last spring, and if you watched Russian state TV, it was also all about Bernie Sanders and how great Bernie Sanders was and how terrible the other Republicans were. So it was Trump and Sanders. It was like the two outsiders that they were really gunning for.
And they also had Jill Stein, at the RT dinner.
Yeah. In some ways, though, I would make the point that it's almost difficult to disaggregate the effects and implications of the Russian active measures from what we saw during the course of the 2016 campaign. It was novel in a way that we had a Republican nominee and later, and before that, a Republican contender who used some of the same language that the Russian propaganda started using in 2015 and escalated in 2016, talking about a rigged system, talking about, in the context of the primary, having all of Colorado's delegates go to Ted Cruz, even though they essentially split the vote. And then, of course, as the election itself became closer, a focus on, again, a rigged system. Hillary could steal the election. Then Republican nominee Trump may not honor the election result. So obviously, the Russian active measures had an effect. But I think even in their absence, the Russians would have been gleeful at what they saw as, you know, perhaps an unwitting accomplice. We hope an unwitting accomplice in the form of Donald Trump, in some ways, doing the same work they sought to do.
Yeah, it's been interesting to me, the on point. You will hear from Russia and sometimes folks, not just in the alt-right world, but in Trump world, and then WikiLeaks, which we know, at least the IC has deemed to be the intentional cutout for the release of these stolen documents and materials, almost the same language you will hear criticizing whoever the opponent or target is of the day. I mean, even with regards to CNN. I mean, WikiLeaks will tweet something about CNN that is almost identical to what you're hearing coming from the White House, even phraseology, and same. Some of the Russian embassy's very active Twitter accounts in the UK or the US will parrot language that you hear. So what you talked about, it wasn't just during the campaign, it's today that you have a common message.
Yeah, well,
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, because I love to make this point, because it drives me crazy when former Director Comey says the Russians are coming back. to your point, they never left.
Right.
I mean, they're still here. They still have all that information. They're in our cyber and in our information sphere.
And it's broader, I think, than just WikiLeaks and the overt or semi-overt organs of the Russian government. I think one thing that we've noticed even after the election, you take what the sort of trending story in alt-right, so-called alt-right circles in this country after the April 4th chemical attack in Syria. And the hashtag Syria hoax started in Russia and with pro-Bashar al-Assad news site and somehow made its way to the United States and started trending in some of the same circles that now are collectively known as the alt-right. And I think the sort of linkage between the two is not something I'm sure we fully understand, how something jumps across the Atlantic like that and tends to land with the same group of people after originating in pro-Russia circles.
You are listening to a live broadcast from the Aspen Security Forum with Active Measures, the Kremlin Plan to Beat the West Without Firing a Shot. This is Aspen Public Radio. It is our summer pledge drive, and we can bring you these live broadcasts only with your financial support. Please call 920-9000 or pledge online at aspenpublicradio.org.
Make a judgment to your boss, write him a report saying, based on what I've seen, is there a case to be made here? Where do you stand on that?
Well, you know, frankly, I was surprised that there would be, you know, explicit documentary evidence pointing to what could be, you know, collusion or conspiracy. Obviously, there's a lot that we don't know about where that meeting went, if it died on the vine there, if there were subsequent conversations. But I would make a point that a former colleague of mine has made in speaking about collusion in plain sight, which I think is something that we often overlook in this context. Yes, there could be covert collusion that Bob Mueller and his team are looking at, but let's talk about what we know. You know, Roger Stone talked openly about speaking with officials from WikiLeaks and knew somehow in advance that, as he put it, John Podesta's time in the barrel would soon be here. But I think more alarmingly, you had the Republican nominee in the final month of the campaign alone, 164 times. Cite WikiLeaks, you know, rave about WikiLeaks. I love WikiLeaks. He talked about Hillary's missing emails. He most explicitly said, Russia, if you're listening, I hope you can find them. So there's this covert collusion, which is, again, I think the jury is still out. But I think we also have to factor in overt collusion. And, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding of the law is that conspiracy need not be hidden from the public in order to be a crime. And so I think we need to look at this holistically when we talk about what may have gone on in the 2016 election.
Looks like you wanted to...
No, I would agree with that, actually. I'm nodding in agreement.
What about the argument, though, that, listen, I mean, there's collusion, and then there's, well, you could say maybe shared interests, right? They could have a more innocent, I mean, not a friendly interpretation, right? How do you respond to that?
Well, so just quickly, I would say it's certainly possible, but I think what makes that less likely is what we know had transpired behind closed doors from Roger Stone to the early June meeting, and then, of course, what we don't know. So if it were just the overt extolling of WikiLeaks, that would be one thing. But I think when you marry these two together, it paints a much more sinister picture.
There are too many unanswered questions. I mean, you know, we forget there's so many meetings by so many Americans, and, you know, we still don't know what was Jared Kushner discussing with Sergei Gorkov, the head of this bank that's sanctioned by the United States that he can't do any business with, you know, and right there in the transition time period. And what was he doing setting up this mechanism? And why are they always trying to hide these meetings? So I think the unanswered questions lead us more towards suspecting that there's some sort of collusion.
The outstanding question that I still have is the one that popped into my head when this first came on our radar is the Russia I know didn't know what the DNC was, and it certainly didn't know what the DCCC was. And if you watched, you know, for example, them trying to, for example, the START Treaty, when it was signed in 2010, I believe, And Obama said, okay, now I have to take this to Congress. And Putin was furious. He said, what do you mean you have to take it to Congress? I too have Congress. You know, they didn't really have a good understanding for how our political system worked. They were so far behind in terms of lobbying on the Hill. And then all of a sudden, you know, they wander into the DCCC servers. They know which precincts in Florida to target, you know, where to disseminate information, false information about Hillary Clinton to drive down voter turnout. Where did they get so smart all of a sudden?
Well, we've reported that that's part of the current investigation, you know, looking at Jared Kushner's data analytics, his famous data analytics. But is it really that hard to figure out where to target? I mean, couldn't you or I just subscribe to the Cook Political Report and say that I need to target, you know, District 37 in southern Michigan? I mean, is it that? I'm curious. You guys have all been in politics for a while. When I've heard that, I say, well, is it that, you know, scientific to figure out where to have sent the best fake news and so on?
It's not if you're, you know, if you're in the soup of Washington and you're constantly hearing about it. But, for example, in the DNI report that came out in January, the illegals were mentioned. I don't know if you remember redheaded hottie Anna Chapman.
Yeah,
from the summer of 2010, you know, these embedded spies that that the Americans were based on, they were here apparently to monitor the 2008 election. And the things they were doing were laughable. It was, you know, it was the Pink Panther.
Right.
Like, Anna Chapman went to buy a burner phone in Brooklyn, and she registered it to a fake address, which was 99 Fake Street. I'm not kidding you. You know, they were going to think tank events and reading newspapers and radioing back to Moscow. So this is, like, it's not hard, but for some reason they were not very good at it before.
Right. Big picture, just for a moment. You know, we asked the question, others are asking, did Russia win or lose? More properly, is Russia winning or losing in this? What have they gained? But is the more appropriate question, is the U.S. losing, right, in that, you know, regardless of what Russia's intentions are, that the loss of confidence, you know, we talk a lot about, and Director Clapper referenced this last year, a broad societal loss of confidence in institutions, right? We see that, God knows, the media, Congress, et cetera, but also now the electoral process. And not just, you know, questions and no evidence of voter tally interference, but people ask questions now about it. And that's an insidious process over time. Is that really the question? You know, is the U.S. losing? And from your point of view, have we effectively lost something from this?
I think we have, but it's not necessarily the Russians' doing. I think we give the Russians a little bit too much credit, and we did a lot of this to ourselves. Also, we don't have to subscribe to the Russian framework for seeing how. So when they see, you know, closed hearings and headlines and leaks, they think, wow, it's a circus, and look at us, we're so stable, we don't leak at all. To me, that's strength. You know, that's our democratic system working and fighting back and trying to right whatever wrongs right. may or may not have happened. They also didn't create Donald Trump. And they didn't create the suspicion toward elites and toward Washington.
And the divisive political environment.
Yes. They didn't create Fox News. Mm-hmm. They also didn't create the Electoral College, which, by the way, tremendously helped the Russians. You know, you can meddle with a few votes in a key state and a key precinct, and it has a massively outsized effect because of how the Electoral College is structured. They didn't create any of these things, and it's not up to them. You know, we can sanction them, we can punish them, we can fret about our loss of standing abroad and questions about our democracy, or we can, you know, kind of shut them out of our brains and think about ourselves and think about how what we did to get here.
I mean, I think domestically we have lost a lot in terms of our own confidence in democracy, and that is a win for Putin, sadly. But I think internationally, there, the harm that we've inflicted upon ourselves has been because of, frankly speaking, who we have in the White House running our foreign policy, because our foreign policy is something that has alarmed, put off, enraged various allies and partners around the world. And so whether it's withdrawing or taking some action that they don't agree with, it's been counterproductive in as much as we've, again, lost friends, lost allies, lost standing.
And Putin didn't do that. Putin isn't, you know, making right. Trump cozy up to Sisi or Duterte and snub Merkel.
Right.
Call me an optimist, but I think we can fix what ails our country. I think, to Evelyn's point, the much more permanent or enduring damage will be the collateral damage to NATO, the collateral damage to the transatlantic relationship, the collateral damage to multilateralism, some of which has been inflicted as a result of, you know, the strange bedfellows that are Putin and Trump, but partially just President Trump. I think what we can't fix is the notion that I think a lot of our allies previously didn't accept, that the United States in all of our history and might could elect a demagogue. I mean, once we've crossed that threshold, there's no putting that genie back in the box. And I think there will be profound doubt going forward. I think there was remarkable confidence in the United States that we would ultimately do the right thing, whether it came to discrete policy decisions or national elections. And I think we may have, you know, lost that latter category, even if we can address sort of the institutional challenges that we've faced more recently.
You are listening to a live broadcast in the Aspen Security Forum with Active Measures, the Kremlin Plan to Beat the West Without Firing a Shot. This is Aspen Public Radio. It is our summer pledge drive, and we can bring you these live broadcasts like this only with your financial support. Please call 920-9000 or pledge online at aspenpublicradio.org.
We're in a rut right now in terms of our international standing as far as being the standard for liberal democracy, but I think we can regain that. It just will take time.
I do want to get more to optimism before we do. The current battle space, as it were, I don't speak to a single person in the Homeland Security world, IC world, Democrat or Republican, who is confident in the current response to current interference from Russia, probing attacks, many of them continuing to probe voter registration systems, et cetera. And we're hearing, and Secretary Kelly said this yesterday, that states are resisting, in fact, federal help. You know, understandably so, there's a political reason for it, but it's kind of like no one's really doing anything, right? I mean, they're talking about it, but no one's doing anything about it. Maybe I'll start with you, Julia, because you know Russia. They did not mess with voter tallies in 2016. Do you think that's a step that they take in 2018 or 2020? Because you wouldn't, again, you don't have to do it. What do we have, 40,000 voting districts in the country? You don't have to do it in 40,000. You could do it in 50 or 10.
Well, that's what I'm saying is that you don't even need to. First of all, I don't know. It's also kind of, are we 100% sure that they didn't do anything?
Yeah, right. And
second of all, you don't need to mess with the tallies if you're doing other things. And if you're, in September, I was in Kent, Ohio, and a Bernie voter, then Jill Stein voter, was telling me about a story she saw about Hillary Clinton having Parkinson's, but for some reason having no tremors, and how did she do that? And by the way, she saw that on Russia Today, and is that any different than NPR, which also gets government funding? Mm. So, you know, you don't need to mess with every single precinct. You don't even need to mess with a single precinct. Mm-hmm. You can turn off voters in a key district in Ohio. And because of the Electoral College, that can have a massively disproportionate effect.
Did you, in your job, and I know you left in 2015, but Ned, I'll ask you the same question. As we have said before this, and you've referenced earlier in the chat now, it's not the first time a foreign power has interfered in different ways, right? China in 2008, so on. But the difference here is the weaponization of the information. But in the past, have you seen a China or a Russia or North Korea or Iran that the key cyber players lay the groundwork for voter interference? You know, I don't know, blow up some registration lists so people, when they show up, they're not there. Have you seen evidence of that?
So my job was in the Department of Defense, so I would not have necessarily come across that unless it was in some bigger, more comprehensive report. But I think the point that I would like to make is that, you know, the Russian government is opportunistic. Putin is opportunistic, and he's a risk taker. So to answer your question about do you think that Putin would actually go further and get into the roles, yes, if he sees the opportunity and he sees that there will be no price to pay, that we're not standing up to him. then he will. Then he might. I shouldn't say he will. I don't know for sure. But he would assess the risk as being relatively low and the gain being as relatively high. And this is across the board. It's not just in the cyber realm. You know, in the Department of Defense, since actually 2012, I mean, we've been talking, at least with, among ourselves in the government, about deterring Russia. Because if you don't stand up to this Kremlin, then they won't stop. I mean, the first, you know, invasion and occupation of one of their neighboring countries happened in 2008. And they're likely to, they repeated it, of course, we know, in Ukraine, in two different parts of eastern Ukraine, and illegally annexed, illegally changed the borders by force, by military force, first time since World War II. And there's a whole litany of other things. I have like 12 things on a list in my pocket that I could read to you. But the reason that they kept doing these things, and to this day, they're still moving the border in Georgia, and again, I can make another list of 12 things they've done since Trump came into office. They don't stop because the price is not high enough. So we have to deter them in the cyber realm, in the conventional military realm, in the asymmetric military unconventional realm, in the information space. And some of it will involve the private sector. Some of it will involve increasing transparency and tightening up our laws, setting up task forces for electoral reform and vigilance in DHS and other places, task force on Russia to look at the dark side interfacing with the white side, if you will, in the financial world, in the cyber criminal world. So that's a long answer.
But
to
you can't, to that point, you can argue that the previous administration did not get the make them pay for it balance right either.
I am on the record advocating for us doing more on deterrence, and certainly with regard to the information operation against our election. I was no longer in government, but I believe we should have done more. So to undo those sanctions out of the four different buckets of sanctions we have, I think would be appalling because we actually need to do more.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you want to jump in?
Yeah. So going back to the 2016 election, mm-hmm. I think in your question, it seemed to be baked in an assumption that the Russians were not going to try to meddle with ballots mm-hmm. to alter vote counts. And that is not true.
You mean they attempted to?
No. There was never an assumption that they wouldn't try and go there.
Right.
There was never an assumption that they had a baked-in red line and they wouldn't go past that. And so I think that's important to understand the response that the Obama administration mm-hmm. undertook, understanding that the paramount objective was to ensure the integrity of the vote itself. And that is why there were a series of both public and private warnings to the Russians starting on August 4th with Director Brennan to his colleague Bortnikov in Moscow that culminated in October 31st when we sent the final message via a longstanding nuclear channel warning the Russians not to do this. Accompanying that was concerted work with the states, 48 of which ultimately worked with DHS to protect their systems. But so it was not a given that we would not be there in 2016. And so I think it cannot be a given that the Russians won't try and go there in 2018 or 2020. This is, to my knowledge, the first time that an adversary has used essentially active measures in the context of an election. And Donald Trump, strangely, has spoken of the North Koreans and, mm-hmm. and others meddling in prior elections. Perhaps others are familiar with that. I am not. But you know, when you look at what the Russians have done in the past vis-a-vis our elections, Julia mentioned the Directorate S officer who was tasked to monitor the 2008 election. In that same January 2017 report, there's also an example of the Russians' recruitment of a Democratic Party activist in the 1970s mm-hmm. To gain intelligence on Jimmy Carter's campaign. Mm-hmm. So this is, certainly a modernization of that tactic, and I think we can be sure that when 2018 and 2020 especially rolls around, they will have developed even newer and more novel tactics, and perhaps they will be bolder. And I agree that should Congress not act on the sanctions bill that is now languishing in the House that passed the Senate with 98 votes, I think that will send a very strong message to Vladimir Putin, especially coupled with the perhaps tepid message he may have received from Donald Trump at the G20 that the green light is on.
I want to go to audience questions, but I just want to ask one more big picture question. There are a lot of very serious people, some who were at this conference, who are serious about fighting off the next attack from whatever country it comes from, Russia, et cetera. At the same time, as I mentioned when I started, you have a a commander-in-chief who, at least in public, doesn't express any sort of great urgency about it or even conviction that it was Russia who did it. And I just was going to recount that a diplomat from a country that I won't name described a conversation between his head of state from a country I won't name with the president, where the president, in that conversation, disagreed with his or dismissed what his Secretary of State said. He said, well, Secretary Tillerson says that, but I'm the president, on a major national security issue, not election meddling. How can, I mean, our partners, but also domestic agencies responsible for this, or states, or even lawmakers, take the effort seriously if the commander-in-chief, or pursue it seriously if the commander-in-chief is not behind it?
That's a huge flaw, and again, as Julia said, not to be put at the door of Vladimir Putin. Mm-hmm. I mean, that unfortunately, this is the way our president manages, because he should put people in place who agree with him, or at least are going to agree with him once he makes the decision. In this case, of course, for people like me, I'm quite happy to see reasonable people who agree with my overall perspective on Russia in cabinet positions across our government, pushing back, trying to educate our president and trying to at least do no harm and perhaps defend us better. I mean, I would imagine they want to defend us better, but I think the president can be an obstacle in this, and I think that puts us in a dangerous situation.
Mm-hmm. Ned or Julia, before we go to the audience?
So I would make the point when it comes to states working with the federal government to fortify their systems. You know, a lot has been made of how the Obama administration tried to be bipartisan in its approach to responding to this. And I think the point that has been lost is that we didn't pursue bipartisanship as a virtue in and of itself. Bipartisanship we saw as an avenue to secure states like Georgia and some of the other southern states especially that may have been resistant to working with the federal government on something as sensitive as electoral infrastructure. Working with Congress to have a bipartisan statement, Democrats and Republicans coming together urging states to work with the federal government. And even that, even with that, that ultimately came around after it was rebuffed by senior members of Congress, even that only led to 48 states. You would think on a challenge as dire and significant as this that all 50 states would be jumping at this offer, but I think it speaks to the need for elected officials from both parties to really sing from the same sheet of music when it comes to the states.
Yeah, I still want to hear who those two states are, but DHS won't say. Julia.
Yeah, I was just going to say, again, that's not Russia's fault that you have Mitch McConnell, just because it's President Obama coming to him and asking him for cooperation on this. You know, the Russians didn't make McConnell an obstructionist who hated President Obama. They didn't make certain states not cooperative with DHS. Again, a lot of this, the Russians are kind of, I mean, there's a lot of talk about counterterrorism at this forum. In some ways, the Russians are terrorists. They're using
fear.
Well, no, they're using loopholes in our society that are usually strengths, right? The same way the 9/11 hijackers weaponized, you know, freedom of travel, student visas, things like that against us. The Russians are doing the same thing in the sense of, you know, they're weaponizing our federalist system, our the partisanship baked into our system. Again, they didn't do that. They're just weaponizing what we have.
You said fear. Yes, they use fear. And I think that's the dangerous aspect of this, because speaking from the military, sort of from the military portfolio that I used to have, or the defense portfolio, the Russians, their military doctrine is very dangerous because it's built on fear and this escalate to de-escalate doctrine, which I won't get into in detail, but the point is that they'll do something so outrageous that we will be back on our heels, we will be afraid that they'll escalate further. In the context of the cyber, you know, the information operation against our elections, one of the reasons I can't get in President Obama's head, but I can well imagine, based on conversations we had in other situations about Russian actions, that he might have been concerned about escalation. So there, that's a fear that the Russians will escalate. So I think they are terrorists also in that respect.
Fear and doubt.
This is Aspen Public Radio, broadcasting at KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale. You are listening to a live broadcast on the Aspen Security Forum with Active Measures, the Kremlin plan to beat the West without firing a shot. This is Aspen Public Radio, and it is our summer pledge drive, and we can only bring you live broadcasts like this with your financial support. So please call right now 920-9000 or pledge online at aspenpublicradio.org, and thank you.
Excuse me. Would disappear from the world tomorrow. Would whoever took over, likely to take over, continue this posture in the world? Or is Vladimir Putin the one who's directing kind of this aggressive stance, not building up the Russian economy in a way that's sustainable? Or is it institutional, that whether he's there or not, this kind of aggressive stance would continue?
You want to take that?
I love this question. Thank mm-hmm. you, Jamie. I think we in America fall into this fallacy that if you just remove Putin, democracy will flourish, and all Russians just, you know, it's like riding a bike. They all just know how to do democracy, and they will all do it. Russia is 143 million little Putins, and
wow.
Goodness. Even some people I love, I include in that category. It really, it's baked into the culture, into the society. I think in some ways, the Russia that we wanted to believe in that existed for 9 years between 1991 and 2000 was a kind of macro historical blip and deviation. Mm. And talking about places with deep states, you have like a lot of the structure in Russia. The reason this is working so well for them is a lot of the system has just been imported wholesale from the Soviet Union. The judges, the clandestine services, the military, the mob, that's not very Soviet. But anyway, there is continuity. And there is, I keep thinking back to something that Vladimir Putin's advisor, who helped him win his very first presidential campaign in 2000 and served with him for over a decade, said, when this system collapses, and it will collapse in a day, and the system that replaces it will be exactly the same.
Hmm. That's remarkable. Evelyn?
Yeah, I mean, I think sort of from a political scientist perspective, the Kremlin, I mean, it's really the Kremlin, the institutions, the organizations, the culture, it's kept together by the autocratic system, obviously, with this veneer of democracy over it, and then this corrupt, kleptocratic economic system. And I think even if you remove Putin, you would still have that system. Yes, you could get a Medvedev-style person in the office of the president, as we saw before, who has a softer edge, who might give on a few things. But the system and the overall objectives of the country wouldn't change. And I think that also gets to what you were saying, I suspect, is under the little Putins. The nationalism comment, the nationalism, yeah. and the real kind of loss of the neo-imperial emotion is still very real in Russia, because the trauma of losing their empire is still very real and fresh. And, you know, it's still real and fresh for the French, for crying out loud. And the Brits only got over theirs because we were like an extension of empire for them. Mm-hmm.
And also, I'm sorry, and then I'll let Ned speak. But the Russians are more like Americans than we like to admit. They too, like us, think that they have a special role to play in history, that they are a great nation that has contributed greatly to Western society, that theirs is a mission given to them by God, and that they're not just some tiny country. They're not the Czech Republic.
They're not just another European country.
Exactly. They're something larger than that, and the 90s were a huge trauma for them. If you want to read something really good about that, I would really recommend reading Secondhand Time by Svetlana Alexievich, who won the 2015 Nobel. And it's all about even people who suffered horribly under the Soviet system, missing the system, missing that the sense of purpose it gave them, the sense of mission, the sense that they were part of something larger. And in that, Americans are very similar.
Yeah, like that Christian West versus the hordes kind of view of the world, which you saw some echoes of, frankly, in the president's Poland speech. Did you want to pipe in on that? You want to go to the next question?
I associate myself with those comments.
Okay, fair enough. How about here, up in nearly the front?
Hi, my name is Drew Danick from the University of Texas at Austin. I'd first like to thank the stage for your service to our country. My question is, we talked a lot about discourse, talked a lot about strife. How, given what the discourse is, given what the strife in our system is, what can we do across the board of our system to show strength to Russia to combat that?
Okay, sorry. But it's your turn to talk. You well, go.
I think one of the most important elements of this, especially as we look forward to 2018 and 2020, is developing antibodies that will help Americans and will be there as we see this come back towards us. I mean, again, the optimist in me hopes that this was a one-time thing and Putin, you know, spent all of his ammunition on 2016, because part of me wants to believe that it can never have the same effect, because Americans are now much more familiar with what a foreign government's covert influence campaign looks like. It's been the topic of conversation since the summer, essentially, and given this administration's foreign policy, I suspect it won't be going away. So I think part of the response will be essentially baked into our psyches, I hope. Perhaps that's optimistic, but...
Can you argue that we're seeing that? I'm just, not to get too Pollyanna-ish here, but listen, you know, you're only 6 months in, but a very divisive time. You have courts making difficult decisions, and sometimes not always in the same vein, but you have a judicial system that's operating independently. You have a attorney general who recused himself, right, which the president clearly didn't like based on his interview yesterday. You have, if I can mention, media not being cowed by the, you know, by the threats from on high. Is it, do you see some optimism in that, Nevelyn or Julia?
Yes, but I would add to that. I think the most important thing, if I could pick one word, and it used to be deterrence, but now it's transparency, because what I've seen is it's really, we have to fight against corruption in our country, in our electoral process, and that starts from everything from, you know, NGOs, I also have an NGO affiliation, the media writ large, where there is money, we need to know where it's coming from, we need to shed light on it, we need to outlaw things that we consider inappropriate foreign interference, we need to make people write down on paper who they're, you know, if they're lobbying the U.S. government on behalf of a foreign government, we need to tighten our laws, we need to enforce them, and basically it just comes down to transparency, getting rid of corruption.
And we need to not get exhausted, and I'm probably just talking to myself up here. Watching all this is exhausting, because every day, just watching the news is exhausting. Forget like reporting it or commenting on it. This drip of crazy news stories coming out of Washington about the Russia story, about what this administration is doing. I think if I'm sick of it and I'm exhausted by it, I can't imagine that people in like Tuscaloosa are thrilled to be getting the next, you know, New York Times push alert. Mm-hmm. So I think being vigilant against that, against indifference and exhaustion.
Mm. But, and Jim, Evelyn mentioned it, I just want to go back to it, and you're more expert on this than I am, but the role of the media, and I think the media's behavior going forward will also, I think, has evolved, and I think and hope that evolution will show through. But you look at what happened in 2016, the most vivid example of which was on October 7th, when the U.S. government formally attributed the meddling to the senior-most levels of the Russian government at 3:30 p.m. And then at 4 p.m., you have an Access Hollywood tape that comes out via the Washington Post. And then at 5 p.m. or later that afternoon, whatever it was, you have John Podesta's emails start to trickle out. And I think what we observed, certainly what I observed, is that there was a lot of attention paid to that statement from during the 30-minute period, from 3:30 to 4 p.m., but then it all went away. And from October 7th until November 8th, there was a media frenzy on John Podesta's emails, focused on the substance and the content, but not the origins.
Right.
And but to be fair, that day I actually happened to be having dinner with a Clinton campaign staffer, and all he could talk about was the Access Hollywood tape. Mm. And the Clinton campaign really emphasized not the October 7th statement, but the Access Hollywood tape.
But it wasn't just the statement. It was, this term is loaded, but the collusion on the part of certain elements in the media and Guccifer 2.0, the Russian cyber persona, who would send scoops to individual reporters and say, hey, you know, you should take a look at this. And then lo and behold, major media outlets would write on the scoops provided by this Russian intelligence officer.
Persona. Collusion. Let's use the word collusion. The media colluded with Russia.
Cooperation, collusion, whatever you want to call it. I mean, it's certainly working with, I imagine, all of the journalists were unwitting at the time. Hopefully that's the case. But it was still certainly cooperation, collaboration, call it collusion.
But that implies active or not witting. That implies not unwitting, rather. That implies witting, collusion.
I think
winning cooperation.
At a certain point, you had to have blinders and earmuffs on not to know that Guccifer 2.0 was a Russian intelligence official.
You are listening to a live broadcast from the Aspen Security Forum with active measures the Kremlin plan to beat the West without firing a shot. This is Aspen Public Radio. It is our summer pledge drive, and we are proud to bring you live broadcasts like this thanks to your financial support. Please call 920-9000. Right now, or pledge online at aspenpublicradio.org. Let's get back.
Saying, President Obama, please tell America. And part of what I was thinking also was, and please tell the campaigns, because they're not getting it. So I think part of this gets back to my macro point, or another macro point I make often, and these guys heard me say it earlier, which is that the intelligence community needs to get better at sharing information with the public and with our partners and allies, declassifying things that we need urgently. Because I think part of the problem was that report that came out, I mean, I was asked to comment on it on TV, and a lot of reporters called me and said, this is weird. Why is this RT thing attached to it? And there was a lot of scoffing at the report, too, which I thought was missing the point, because it's not how the report looks and what was in it. I mean, it's the message. It's what the Russians are trying to do. And so I think the intelligence community needs to do a better job providing more information and declassifying. And I know we have to preserve our sources and methods, but at some point, you know, sometimes maybe you have to actually compromise some kind of source or method if it comes down to saving American democracy.
Yeah, there was. I remember the January report, and it was a little disappointment. You're like, it lift the veil a little more. But I understand dealing with you guys that a lot of the stuff is very close hold. Just because we're getting close to 5 minutes, I want to try to get. I would love to get two more questions in, but where can we go here? In the blue shirt here.
Hi, Charlie Dillon.
Him first, and then we'll come to you. But if you make it short, you got the mic, and then if you make it short, we'll try to get both in.
Will do. Charlie Dillon from Duke Law. Jay Tapper interviewed Hillary Clinton during the campaign, and she said that she had been contacted by foreign leaders wanting to endorse her to, quote, stop Trump. Jake did press her a bit as to who they were, but she wouldn't disclose who these foreign leaders were. I'm thinking, number one, should we assume that they shut everything down and didn't try to do anything else to influence the campaign? And would it help if we broaden the discussion about all foreign nations who are trying to influence our campaigns? Or am I completely wrong?
Do you see significant evidence of other governments, even friendly ones?
So I would start with the proposition that it's natural for governments to have policy preferences. Mm-hmm. Clearly, I would suspect lots of the NATO member countries were made uncomfortable listening to Donald Trump during the campaign speak of NATO being obsolete. So I think the issue is that in today's environment, there has been an attempt at criminalization of policy preferences on the part of foreign capitals. But I think we have to remember it's a far cry from a NATO member country, you know, privately rooting for Hillary Clinton and strategic adversary getting involved in our election with active measures, covert influence, social media, you name it.
They weren't probing and scanning our election infrastructure, yeah.
Right. Gentlemen here, there's a mic right over your shoulder.
Has any of you considered the business role of the president and Russia? Because he has, right now, no one will lend him money in New York City. No one will do business with him in New York City. He owes a great deal of money. Where does he get the money? And there are a lot of rumors that he gets it in Russia. Mm-hmm. Have any of you explored any of that?
Well, his son said they get most of their money or a predominant amount of money.
Both his sons said.
Both his sons, right.
And Mueller reiterated today, timing interestingly, after the president's comments yesterday that business ties are going to be within the scope of the investigation.
And it wouldn't be, it's not a crazy proposition either. He's doing real estate in New York and Florida, and guess where Russians who want to park their money outside of Russia, guess where they want to buy real estate? New York and Florida.
I agree. I think it's also a bit broader, and I think framework to look at this president's foreign policy and some of the oddities of it. You know, his embrace of people like Duterte and Erdogan and Putin. You look at the countries where the rhetoric has been much softer than we might have expected, and even an affinity with those leaders. And I think there's a very significant correlation with Trump investments. So I think, you know, we sort of have to look through the conflict of interest lens when it comes to foreign policy more broadly, not just at Russia.
And some of it, as you're saying, hiding in plain sight, right? Yes. I mean, it's not on the down low.
But the influence that the Russians have on him may be greater because of these business ties and because he may owe them money. And then, of course, there's the issue of his campaign manager and all the work that he was doing and now whether he was indebted to Russians or not.
It was interesting, the $17 million in debt, and then there was a $17 million payment that came from a Ukrainian-tied business.
But that's
probably just an accident. Yeah. We could probably squeeze one more in if just you here.
Good afternoon, panelists. Thanks for speaking with us. My name is Justin Gerard. I'm a rising junior at the University of Notre Dame. And I'm curious, you spoke about the IC and maybe disclosing, being more transparent about where their information is coming from. And I know that's kind of been an enduring problem after the election process was this distrust of the IC. But if they're unable to disclose those sources and means to enable future national security efforts, who in the government should be taking responsibility for going to bat for the IC if it's not going to be coming out of the executive branch?
So Ed, maybe you're a CIA alum.
Going to bat for the IC in terms of protecting it as an institution?
Vouching for the information that they're releasing with the American people. I'm from a small farm town.
I would say Congress,
in Indiana.
If I could.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't take it.
Right.
You know, I think there have been a couple instances where we have dealt with this. In the aftermath of the downing of MH17, there was a presentation derived from intelligence that demonstrated the assessment that this came from
Russian missile,
exactly, in a rebel area. Obviously, in the aftermath of the 2014 chemical attack in the Damascus suburb and elsewhere, but it's always, as someone who was in the intelligence community, it goes against the instincts of an intelligence analyst or officer more broadly to see that information being presented publicly. You know, intelligence is collected for the benefit of policymakers, and it's collected to present policymakers with an array of options and opportunities that they can then act on. It's never comfortable as an intelligence officer to see that information then made public. Having moved to see this from the policy community, I certainly understand quite a bit more why it's necessary, and I think it's actually indispensable when it comes to efforts like this. But I think the problem now, and to make this even more topical, is that there has been an assault on the intelligence community from the executive branch itself. And so I think going forward, we're going to have a problem where if there is another MH17 or if there is another instance of Russian meddling, the intelligence community, the presentation, will be crippled by the very statements that we've heard come from the President of the United States and his spokesperson. So I think that is another institution in broader American society whose reputation has suffered needlessly and wrongly, in my opinion. And it's one that I think we'll have to, we'll pay a price for that the next time there is an exposition of classified intelligence more broadly.
All right, we're gonna have to, strict time limits here, so we're gonna have to leave it there. Let me please thank and ask you to thank Ned, Evelyn, and Julia. Thanks, guys.
This is Aspen Public Radio, and you've been listening to a live broadcast from the Aspen Security Forum. In about an hour or so, we'll probably have this discussion up in full later today for sure, sometime on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Support for Aspen Public Radio comes from Plato's Restaurant at the Aspen Meadows Resort, a short walk from the Benedict Music Tent. Plato's offers a dining locale overlooking Castle Creek and the Aspen Peaks, featuring local and regionally sourced products and serving dinner nightly from 5 until 10 p.m. Reservations at platosaspen.com. You've been listening to a live broadcast from Aspen Security Forum with active measures the Kremlin plan to beat the West without firing a shot. This is our summer pledge drive, and we would love to encourage you to call 920-9000 or pledge online at aspenpublicradio.org.